So has anybody noticed that meditation is hard sometimes? Difficult? And maintaining a practice, sometimes not so easy? It always cracks me up when I'm ready to go on a retreat and someone says, "Have fun, Eddie." Okay, we'll see how that works out. And just motivating ourselves to sit down and do a practice on a consistent basis can be so difficult, and yet it's so critical to have that consistency. So I picked out a topic tonight that's a practice that I do that helps me prepare myself to do meditation. I do it usually most every time at the beginning of my meditation. I take a couple minutes to do this, at least. And I've known about this practice for quite a while, but I was especially motivated when I did my first retreat with a Buddhist teacher, Lee Brazington. And he suggested 5 things to do at the start of a sitting. First thing he said was generate gratitude. Second thing is, why am I doing this? What's my motivation? Third, he said, work up some determination. You know, I'm not just going to sit down and go into some kind of fantasy and 30 minutes, 40 minutes later say, okay, I meditated. The fourth thing he suggested is doing some loving kindness, doing some metta practice at the beginning, definitely for yourself. Just take and do a little bit of that. That kind of helps open up the heart. And then the fifth thing he said was to do a little mantra, or it's a gata, that Thich Nhat Hanh has really popularized just by saying, breathing in, I calm my body and mind. Breathing out, I smile. So as we go into our mindfulness of breathing, just saying a few phrases just to kind of direct the mind. Well, the 4 thoughts that turn the mind to the Dhamma really help with those first 3, the gratitude, the motivation, and the determination. So we'll talk about that. And I'm going to quickly tell you what the 4 thoughts are. The first one is this precious human birth. Just appreciating how precious this birth is. The second is thinking about impermanence, really reflecting on impermanence. The third is thinking about the law of karma, of cause and effect. And the fourth is thinking about the nature of suffering, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. So we'll go through each one of these. Now this practice is done a lot in the Tibetan tradition, and I spent a lot of time doing Tibetan practices. I've part of groups for many, many years doing the Vajrayana, as it's called. And in the Tibetan tradition, very often, this is one of the very first practices that one engages in before anything else. The 4 thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma, as they call it. And in the Vajrayana, it's thought of as a preliminary practice. In the Tibetan tradition, you're often, or almost always, asked to do certain preliminary practices, if you're doing it in the traditional way. And it's the belief that we need to do certain purification practices before we can start doing the more difficult challenge of really investigating the mind. And I was practicing a long time in the Nyingma tradition, and we had something called the Nundro that I was supposed to do. All of us were supposed to do. And there's a series of practices. Each one of them involved 100,000 repetitions. So, for example, one of them was 100,000 prostrations, full prostrations, doing a mantra. So these are the kind of things that they do these preliminary practices. And I lived for a year at a Tibetan retreat center in the high desert of New Mexico. It was called Iron Knot Ranch, and it was founded by a very esteemed Tibetan teacher named His Holiness Chagdub Tukul Rinpoche. And he escaped from Tibet in 1959, ended up setting centers up, and he died around 2004, something like that. But the center that I was at had been established by him, and there was a Western teacher, and I learned this practice, and I did the Nundro. And in his book, Gates to Buddhist Practice, Chogdruk Tukul said, "The four thoughts are what keep us going. The contemplation of the four thoughts is among the most profound and beneficial practices on the path to enlightenment. For these are the fundamental truths that underlie the entire spiritual path." Now, this is pretty heavy duty, what he's saying here. It's an interesting story that I heard from his wife. It was a Western woman that he married, and she was still living when I was at Iron Knot, and she told a story about how when she and Rinpoche got married, he was able to go back to Tibet in 1987. You know, he hadn't been there since 59. And he sought out and found his original teacher, who was at that time in his 80s. It was in eastern Tibet in the section called Kham. And so he's so excited to see his teacher and introduce him to his wife. And he also brought his son, who was also a Lama, Jigme Rinpoche. So he goes to see the teacher, and his name was Tromge Erik Rinpoche. So when he gets there, Rinpoche, like, "Well, how do you do? Nice to meet you. And very nice to meet you. And I have to be going. I have to focus on practicing the four thoughts." And, you know, Rinpoche is going like, wait a minute, I haven't seen you in all this time. I just traveled halfway around the world. He goes, "I need to do my practice." And it was the four thoughts that he practiced. The great yogi Milarepa was asked, "How hard is your practice?" He replied, "It's harder than carrying salt from the salt beds." To transport salt in Tibet, one had to fill a wet yak skin with wet salt and press it until the skin bulged and then let it dry. This is how they transported it. And this dried yak skin, this hard rock, you carry around. And Milarepa said it was easy to carry these rocks of salt up and down a mountain all day long than to meditate. So this is why we do this practice, is to condition the mind. We really need to strive to set a foundation for our practice. And this is one that you can do. Otherwise, it's going to lapse. So let's take a look at each one of these. The first I want to focus on is appreciating the precious human life. I actually did a whole Dharma talk on this topic months and months ago. The Buddha told a wonderful parable. He said, imagine an old blind turtle. Some of you have heard this, I know. An old blind turtle that lives at the bottom of the seven oceans and who surfaces once every century for air. Floating randomly around the seas, there's a golden yolk. As often as the blind turtle at the bottom of the ocean happens to raise his head through the neck hole of the yolk when he comes up for his breath, that's the likelihood of being born into a human life form. Now, in the Tibetan tradition, they especially emphasize there's all these other realms besides the human birth. We don't talk about it too much in this tradition, but it is a teaching. But just reflect on how rare your human birth is. For every human, how many billions of other life forms are there on this earth? We weren't born an insect or a sardine. We were born a human. And with such rare opportunity, we should really appreciate what we have. We might reflect how wonderful our life form is in this human embodiment. Lucky to have the freedom, the opportunity that this presents. Ever wonder, what's the purpose of my life? Right? We all have. Well, what could be more meaningful than waking up, seeing the true nature of our minds, the true nature of reality? Sometimes I think it might be more appealing to be a dog or a cat, you know, You just lie on its back, and master comes over and scratches. You get fed, all your needs are cared for. Could be a little appealing, not too much stress, right? At least in this culture. But this is the only form that really allows us the opportunity to achieve enlightenment. Our precious human birth endows us with 10 special qualities and conditions, 5 of which derive from who we are, the other 5 from outer circumstances. So the 5 qualities from who we are. The first quality is having a human body, a vehicle for attaining enlightenment. The second is having a birth in an area where the teachings are available. Now, we kind of take this for granted now because of the internet. I mean, you can get on, and no matter pretty much wherever you live in the world, most places there's internet. You could Google and find dharmaseed.org and listen to a talk and watch videos and stuff like that. But it's not true everywhere. What if you lived in Saudi Arabia, where this sort of thing is frowned on? What about North Korea? You can get shot, probably. Another one of the qualities is having faculties that are intact and sufficient enough to enable us to understand the teachings. Not everyone has the capacity to understand the teachings. Not all of us have the hearing, the eyesight, the stability of mind. The fourth is the blessings of karma, some kind of karmic disposition to want to develop spiritually. So many people come into this existence and it never occurs to them to do anything other than toll the bell. What was that Jackson Brown line, something about just striving to be the happy idiot and struggle for the legal tender? That's the norm. Most everybody that drives up and down the street, that's all they live for. But we have this aspiration to really want to seek enlightenment. This is a quality that comes with human birth. And just a receptivity to the Buddhist path. There's a lot of ways up the mountain, okay? But we're here, and just having the receptivity and the willingness is another quality. Outer conditions, outer circumstances. There was a Buddha. I mean, we sort of take it for granted, right? Well, we happen to be born into a universe where one appeared. Having appeared, he chose to teach. You know, after 6 years on the road, going through all his ordeals, at the age of 35, he finally reached enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. He could have just kicked back and said, hey, this enlightenment stuff's pretty good. You know, no dukkha? I think I'll just chill on this. But no, he decided to see if there were people who had so little dust in their eye that they could understand it. He spent the next 45 years teaching. Even though people were trying to kill him, he had to deal with all these unruly monks and people and difficulty, and he kept doing it till the age of 80 when he died. Another outer circumstance is that the teachings were preserved. I mean, the Buddha was over 500 years BC. Well, when did the printing press come around? It was like 1400 or something. You know what these monks had to do? They had to memorize all these teachings and then pass it on generation to generation. Then they had to write it out on these leaves. What were they, banana leaves or palm leaves or something? What were they, Rania? Do you remember?
Yes, I know, but it's not coming
out. Yeah, so they had to write this out. Well, these things have a shelf life, right? So then, after a while, you got to write it out again. This went on for hundreds of years so that we could have these teachings. The presence of practitioners who can provide a living example to us. A sangha, right? Some people have no access to a sangha. I've been there. You know, Indonesia, there was no sangha around me. And the commitment and kindness of teachers. These are outer conditions. And we can add some others. Having a place, a space where we can come and sit. You know, the fact that someone decided to start this sangha. What was it? Almost 7 years ago now? 6, 7 years ago? Having resources, books, and so on. So, contemplating our great fortune again and again, especially before we sit, inspires us to practice with greater diligence and enthusiasm. You know, if we knew that gold was buried in our yard somewhere, how much effort would we make to try to find it. Right? Would we even bother? Yeah, I think so. Well, if we appreciated our precious human birth in the same way, you know, why would we waste it? When I also lived at a Zen center for a while, and they had this thing called a han. It's a wooden board. And on it, there was a writing. And this is pretty typical of what you'll find on these hans. It says, "Great is the matter of birth and death. Time slips quickly by. Time waits for no one. Wake up, wake up. Don't waste a moment." If you go out to Southern Dharma Retreat Center, they have one outside the meditation hall. And before the sit, we would go out and strike the han with a mallet to let people know that the sit was going to begin. And it was made out of wood. And after you hit it just so many times, it would split in half. Another demonstration of impermanence. We had a little bet going, which one of us could break the han. I lost. I didn't win. The second of the great thoughts is thinking about impermanence. And this is one of the three basic facts of existence, anicca. It's fact. Being impermanent, all things are going to die, including us. And it might be useful to reflect on the five remembrances. And these are, as translated by Thich Nhat Hanh, the first remembrance: I'm of a nature to grow old. There's no escape growing old. Two, I'm of the nature to have ill health. I'm of the nature to die. We don't get out of this alive, right? All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. Those are the first four of the five remembrances. We'll get to the other one later. So to understand the root of suffering, which is another one of the four thoughts, we have to acknowledge that nothing in life is permanent. We perceive phenomena, including our physical body and everything we experience with our senses, to be solid and lasting, right? That's our perception. We look at this table, we look at each other, we look at this building, we think it's solid and lasting. Well, it's not. I'm not the same Eddie that you saw when you walked in here, and I'm not the same Eddie who's going to be here at the end of the talk. We change our whole body in 7 years, right? Change is continuous. But the thing is, most changes happen so slowly we don't really notice and we don't really have a sense of impermanence. The Buddha said, decay is inherent in all component things. According to the teachings of the Buddha, life is comparable to a river. It's a progressive movement, a successive series of different moments. You can't step into the same river twice. That's what Heraclitus said. One of those Greek guys back 2,000 years ago. Pretty smart guy. It reminds me of a fellow who told me that he had just had his first date. Now, this is an older guy, like me, right? He had just had a date with another woman. And he's telling the story. He says, first date, he says, I looked at her and I said, take a good look, because this is as good as it gets. He knew he was already, right? It's not going to get better. Thich Nhat Hanh said, impermanence is the constant transformation of things. Without impermanence, there can be no life. So the time of my death is uncertain. You know, I assume I'm going to get out there afterwards, get in my truck and drive home, and I'm going to come back here and I'm going to see all your wonderful people again. I might not be here. You might not be here. We don't know when life is over. What if we practice with a sense of urgency, understanding we don't know if we're going to be here tomorrow? We don't know when our time is up. Motivated? Maybe. The fifth remembrance is what comes up now. The fifth remembrance is, my actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. They're the ground upon which I stand. So the third of the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma is thinking about karma, cause and effect. As Ruth Denison the great Buddhist teacher who passed about a year or so ago, as she put it, you can't get away with nothing. Karma is like a seed with the proper conditions. It'll yield a plant. If you sow a carrot seed, pretty good chance, under the right conditions, you're going to get a carrot. Not going to get a pepper seed. You're not going to get a pepper plant, right? Unless you plant a pepper seed. So the mind is like this fertile field. All sorts of things grow there. But when we plant a seed, an action, a statement, a thought, it'll produce a fruit which will ripen, fall to the ground, and produce more of the same. Ever notice that? Every moment we plant potent seeds of causality with our mind, our thoughts, our speech, our body. And when the right conditions come together and our karma ripens, we have to deal with the consequences of what we've sown. But even though we're responsible for what we sow, we often forget what we've planted. And then we either give credit to or blame other people or situations outside each other for what shows up. We lose sight of the fact that each thought, word, and deed will produce an action, a result. Then we say, why did this happen to me? I did nothing wrong. I was thinking of the movie The Unforgiven. And some of you that saw it may remember a scene towards the end of the movie. And this is when William Money, who was played by Clint Eastwood, right? This is his act of retribution at the end, right? And he's got this gun and he's pointed it towards this character named Little Bill, who was played by Gene Hackman. And he's got it pointed at him. And Little Bill knows that he's a goner, right? And he says, he looks up and he goes, I don't deserve this, to die like this. I was building a house. And Eastwood's character says, it's got nothing to do with deserve. Sometimes shit just happens. Did we deserve it? Well, there's laws of karma and effect, cause and effect. So reflecting on karma reminds me of the value of my practice. If I'm working with my mind, I have an opportunity to understand how my mind works, start working with these thoughts, which impact my behavior. Everywhere we look in the universe, we see things arising and passing away, dependent on conditions, galaxies and stars down to microorganisms. Nothing's random. They all have causes and effect. So my life is the product of all kinds of influences. But I can change the conditions that spring from my mind through my practice. I can change how I think. I can change how I feel. And it'll show up in my speech and my actions. I've seen this happen. You know, I used to think if I meditated, I would see the impact of my meditation in my meditation. Well, I do to some extent, but where I see the impact of my practice mostly is when I'm off the cushion. Now, I'll be in a situation, something will happen, I'll have some experience, and all of a sudden I realize that kind of stuff used to really piss me off. I used to react. And now I'm just like, okay, I can just let it go. You know? I'm really grateful that I'm not creating more wreckage, more karmic issues. One of the things we do in terms of working with our karma is practicing the precepts, right? The five precepts. We undertake the training to abstain from killing, from taking what is not given, avoiding sexual misconduct, abstaining from false speech, and abstaining from mind-altering substances that cause heedlessness. These are practices that when we follow, they create a foundation for our practice and can impact what shows up in our life. The fourth of the turning the mind to the Dharma through the four thoughts, the fourth one is thinking about the nature of suffering, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. So, our thoughts, feelings, speech, actions, whether they're virtuous or non-virtuous, are going to create life experience. We create the causes for our own happiness and our own suffering. The Buddha said the cause of suffering is in our mind. When we understand this, we can help eliminate some of these causes. On his enlightenment, Buddha identified suffering as the nature of our experience. And when he identified the cause of suffering, and then he identified the cause of suffering, because we are so strongly attached to the material world, it's really vital to examine with care whether these worldly activities really benefit us. It's very tempting to live and strive for upgraded samsara. Things are going pretty well here. I think I'll just coast for a while. You know, and we can work hard to obtain these things, but we'll find that clinging to this world is just a source, you know, it's a false sense of safety and happiness, false sense of satisfaction. The Buddha said there are three kinds of suffering. The first is the suffering of change. Nothing's reliable or consistent, no matter how much we hope for a firm foundation to stand on. Impermanence, right? No matter how seemingly pleasurable and attractive our place of living, our physical body, our sensory enjoyments, our situation's not going to remain as it is. It's bound to change. So to cling to this, to cling to this is really setting ourselves up for dissatisfaction. And when that happens, the cause of our pleasure becomes a cause of suffering. The sorrow caused by the death of a child happens because we were so happy when the child was alive, when there was no pain. The second type of suffering is suffering on top of suffering. It's like you get compound interest in the bank. This is compound suffering, right? Suffering earning interest. One bad thing leads to another, and there just seems to be no fairness to it. One of the suttas says, what is the suffering upon suffering? It is that which is painful when arising, painful when remaining, pleasant when changing. Ah, it's over. Did you ever notice one thing happens and then another and another and another, and it's like, I just want to call time out sometimes. That's the way it is. The third type of suffering is pervasive suffering. As surely as we're born, we'll become sick, age, and die. No matter what we're experiencing, whether we're experiencing temporary pleasure or suffering, or even a neutral state, we're always setting ourselves up for future suffering. We just can't run from it. All our present experiences have the potential as causes for suffering. It's as if all our meals have been laced with poison. And if we eat and drink unaware, the pain and suffering will come. The Buddha said, the suffering of being conditioned is not apparent when it arises, remains, or ceases, but it's still the cause of suffering. Every aspect of our conditioned existence brings with it the potential for future suffering. And it's known as the all-pervasive suffering of conditioned existence. Wanting life to be other than the way it is, it's a trap. This craving and aversion that we swing back and forth with, it just guarantees dukkha. But when we practice meditation, we can experience this, we can notice this, we can watch our minds, we can start having insights into the nature of how things are. Knowing this is a big motivator for me. So in summary, these are the four thoughts. Reflecting on precious human life, thinking about impermanence and impending death, the opportunities that we have. Three, thinking about the laws of karma, cause and effect, how our behavior affects what we experience. And four, thinking about the nature of suffering, dukkha. So in my practice, what I'll do is at the beginning, I might run through all four. I might just briefly reflect on each one of them about this precious human life, this opportunity that I have, about impermanence, that everything is going to change, and I don't know how much more time I have to practice. I think about the laws of karma, cause and effect, and it's really a motivator for me to practice, to think that if I can really start using my mind as a servant rather than having it run the show, I have an opportunity to create different causes, different effects with my speech and my actions. And reflecting on the nature of suffering, dukkha, unsatisfactory, you know, the causes of it. So, you know, you can use this. Sometimes I'll just pick one. I might just focus on one and just spend some time on that. Sometimes I run through all four. It just depends on what's going on. But all of these can really be a motivator to help set the tone for your meditation. You can also use it if you're going to listen to a Dharma talk. You know, these Dharma talks that we have available to us online and so on, every Sunday we have one presented to us. You know, these are a great opportunity. So this is another way just to create motivation and determination and gratitude to receive the teachings. So I wanted to offer them to you to see if it's something that might be of value to you.